Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on today's episode of Wandering DMs, Action Economy Part 2, Second Attack. when we took a crack at this 2 weeks ago, Paul, if you recall, and we only got to about half of what we really intended. So last time we were talking about things like how long is a round, and like how much actual time is it supposed to be, which has changed over editions. And are you using a phased sequence of like move then attack, or do you do everything, or how does the initiative order work, which has changed over editions like that? And we never actually boiled down to like other than drinking potions, which everybody should go look for Paul's experimental how much potion can I drink while simultaneously fighting someone video, which is pretty awesome. We never boiled it down to actually how it affects play. How many attacks do you get, and how many spells do you get, and how it actually affects the play? So I think both of us were, and several of our viewers were left still hungry for that, the second attack, which is happening right now.
But before we get to that, let's just very quickly plug our subscription drive, which is, you got 7 days left, so if you are subscribed or not subscribed, you can enter to win a bunch of cool prizes, right? The grand prize includes like a shirt and some print books and cards and all kinds of stuff that we've produced.
And signed and
put together. Signed by us, yep. And there's a whole bunch of
cool gifts we could think of,
And a bunch of first prizes that is all that, but just in digital format instead of physical format. So you can enter to win now up until next week when this when this contest will end, simply by subscribing to the channel. And if you're already subscribed, you can still enter. So please enter the contest.
Go to our website, wanderingdms.com. Click through the top thing. There is our subscription drive. It takes about four clicks when I tested it. One, two, three, four clicks, and you're in the running for a free package of everything that Wandering DMs has ever produced to date, actually. Feel free to tell your friends about it. I'm sure you can cut some kind of deal with your close friends about if they get the package, you split it up. That might be a fun idea. So, go to our website and look for that subscription
I'm gonna make
drive.
It even easier for you by posting the direct link to the drive to the contest right here in our chat.
Now that's too easy, Paul. That's not what the channel's about. There needs to be some kind of challenge to it. I disagree with this move from Wandering DM Paul. It should be more challenging.
Oh, jeez. Okay. So, the other thing I'll point out...
Before we get into it, let me just point out that don't forget our next show next Sunday, where we'll have James Malazuski of Grognardia as our guest.
Yeah,
and we'll
that
look forward
be
to that on September 20th.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll just point out, Dan and I talked very briefly before the beginning of this show and agreed that there should not be a third part to this. So we are going to cut ourselves off at the end of this show, even if we don't get it done. I don't know, maybe something will carry over to season three, but there's not going to be a third part to this.
He said, later, he predicted, all statements are forward-looking and not necessarily financial guarantees.
Awesome.
So let's get into it.
Yeah, let's.
One thing that has gotten way more traction on my Twitter feed in the last 24 hours than I expected was the question, how many attacks do your fighters get? Just plain old fighters. I mean, plain vanilla stock D&D fighters. How many attacks do they get? Now, you go back to original chainmail, right? And this is a point before you had the idea of incremental leveling. And the initial thing that made powerful fighter heroes or superheroes like Conan interesting is the rule was just like, you know what? Roll more dice, right? Normal fighters roll 1d6. If you're a hero, roll 4 dice, right? And if you're a superhero like Conan, roll 8 dice. How about that? Just roll a whole bunch of separate dice. They were not at higher levels of proficiency. You didn't have a higher chance of hitting. You had the same chance of hitting. You're just rolling more dice.
Yep.
And that got carried through. That was actually consistent, at least against normal targets, normal men, normal orcs, things like that. That was actually a consistent rule through chainmail, original D&D, advanced D&D, all the way through second edition, is that your fighter has actually got a number of attacks against mooks, normal things, according to their level. So if you're a 10th level fighter and you're fighting normal men, normal sailors, normal goblins, you get 10 attacks per round.
Now, how did they define mooks, Dan? What's where's the line?
It shifted a little bit.
Yeah.
In chainmail, it just said normals. In original D&D FAQ, it said up to one hit die, and then by the time of first edition, it said less than one hit die. So it was somewhere around the one hit die level.
Okay. Yep. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Great. Great.
Some people really like that. Some people really like this. I'm a Conan-esque by eighth level, and I can just chop through a whole boat full of opponent pirates or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, one of the things I kind of don't like about it is the radical discontinuity. Is that, yeah, I'm 10th level, I get 10 attacks per round for normal men orcs with one hit die, and then as soon as you get one more hit point from that, my number of attacks collapses back down to a much lower number.
Mm-hmm.
So personally, my analysis is I'm not happy about those kinds of radical discontinuities from a teeny tiny little change, like one hit point difference.
Right, right, right. Okay. Okay. So what do you prefer?
Well, okay. So you move forward. First edition AD&D started indicating even for higher level targets, maybe you get two attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that's familiar to many of us in third edition, fifth edition. My own house rules actually have a feat where you can pick up and you get two attacks instead of one.
Yep.
Now, that still has the problem of the discontinuity. Is I'm first, second, third level and I'm getting one attack, and then all of a sudden, at some point, my attacks double. Mm-hmm. I've had many people critique my house rules that particular ability is way overpowered compared to all the other ones.
What are you going to do, go up by a fraction? That's ridiculous, right?
I'm so glad you made that segue together, Paul. Absolutely. Absolutely. So in first edition, that's absolutely what you did. So if I look at my handy-dandy player's handbook that I just happen to have right here, yeah, absolutely. Fractional. I'm not doing that super well.
Yeah.
Fractional attacks.
Yep.
So if you are a fighter of level 7 to 12, you get 3 attacks every 2 rounds. And then if you're a fighter level 13 and up, you get 2 attacks every single round. So they did have a 3 attacks per 2 rounds rule.
Yep.
How did you feel about that, Paul? Did you ever play with that?
I did, actually. You know, when I was in high school, and this is actually, you know, so this is my gaming history, right? Yeah, I think we've talked about this a lot. But my gaming history is starting with BX and then rolling in first edition AD&D, Player's Handbook only, and then mixing those two together into some weird amalgam. Until I got to high school. By the time I was in high school, we were playing second edition AD&D. And this is probably where I actually had like a regular group. This is the first time I had like a regular group that was getting together all the time weekly to play, and we were really into it and knew what the hell we were doing, right? And it was a much less slapdash experience. And yeah, we played with that. And my experience is it confused everyone. The initial reaction is like, what does that mean? I don't understand. Then finally explain, oh, well, you get two attacks on round one and then one attack on round two and ping pong back and forth. And then you go, okay, I get it. And then you screw up tracking it, right? Oh,
exactly.
What did I do last round? I can't remember. Yeah,
exactly.
It's just a pain in the ass, and I never liked it.
William in the chat is also pointing out that it got even worse. Like, I think he's referring to the supplemental Unearthed Arcana specialization rule, where you might possibly have, depending on the weapon, you might have 5 attacks every 2 rounds. I guess I'm seeing that. Maybe there's some way you can get 5 attacks every 3 rounds. So it got even more. It got even more complicated than that in first edition.
Didn't you also have like? I want to say that certain ranged weapons were just got multiple attacks with always because of the weapon, right?
That is correct. In first edition, here's where you start debating, like, well, was the round really supposed to be 1 minute or was it supposed to be 6 seconds? Yeah, the longbow, you automatically get 2 attacks per round with it anyway. Now, that has its roots all the way back in chainmail, where mass missile units could roll two dice per round. But again, I look at that, but and I look at that and go, but isn't that because you have multiple ranks firing? Is what I look at that. So I feel like the two attacks for a longbow itself is possibly accidental, an accidental reflection of having multiple ranks firing, as opposed to swordsmen, where you only have one rank attacking.
I like systems that inverted this. I feel like somebody's looking at the list of range weapons and going, like, surely longbows are faster than crossbows, right? And I like systems that have shifted this in the direction of, okay, crossbows are slow, so you need a round to reload them.
Well, first edition had both.
First edition had both.
So it had longbows firing twice around. It had light crossbows once around, heavy crossbows once every other round. So the difference between longbows and heavy crossbows was a times four difference in first edition, which, again, if you do like a damage per round analysis, is just completely lopsided. Did anybody ever use heavy crossbows in first edition? No, of course not. Everybody was using longbows, which was shooting out four times the number of missiles every round.
Let me mention this notion, you know, it carries all the way forward into fifth edition. I had to look this up on Friday when I was running my fifth edition game. And I thought, are crossbows slower in fifth edition? And the weird thing is they have, I'm going to try and find it. They have a trait on crossbows that says something about them being slow. Now I'm not finding it.
Loading, I'm certainly relying on Paul here.
And it says because of the time required to load this weapon, you can fire only one piece of ammunition from it when you use an action, bonus action, or reaction to fire it, regardless of the number of attacks you can normally make. So basically, what they've done is crossbows always have a fire rate of one shot per round. Even if you're a fighter who would normally get two shots per round or some other reason, some other mechanic is giving you. Right. It's so fidgety.
A little fiddly. I agree. Why? That's a little fidgety. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Now, aside from the weapon issue, you know, other iterations of the how do you determine multiple attacks, someone on my Twitter feed yesterday said, well, whatever the fighter's attack bonus is, I let them split it up into as many attacks as they want. So if they have a +8 attack bonus and they want to do three attacks with +5, a +2, and a +1, I let them do that. Wow. If they want to do eight attacks all at +1, I let them do that.
Wow, I've never heard
and
of that.
And that's actually, that's not too far. Yeah, that was novel to me, but it echoes the third edition rule, whereby for everybody, fighters, wizards, whoever, whatever your base attack was, you get a number of multiple attacks in gradations of 5. So if your base attack bonus was 12 in third edition, you get one attack at the bonus of 12. You get a second attack at a bonus of 7. You get a third attack at a bonus of 2 every single round. And so we were having to track all those different attacks and all those different separate attack bonuses every single round in third edition. And like you're saying, Paul, we would when we were playing, we would forget, was that the first one or was that the second one? And we have players, right, that were unaccustomed to that and not realize that every single one of the attacks were at a different bonus. But it at least, that's another way, aside from the fractional attacks, that they were trying to address not having a radical discontinuity, which I do think is a legitimate problem.
I feel like, too, there's a slight echo there of the chainmail idea of you just have this many dice, right? You just have this many dice, so split them up however you want, right? I feel like one other thing we should touch on before we lose thread on it is we were talking a little bit there about range combat. I feel like, and we probably talked about this a little bit 2 weeks ago when we started this, but a big question that comes up often is then switching weaponry, right? Especially when you're talking about I've got a longbow, I get two attacks with it, but I'm a fighter who gets three attacks every two rounds. You know, when can I shoot with my bow and then switch to my sword, and how much action is that? And I think, Dan, that you and I have probably come to similar conclusions here where we're like, well, like dropping a thing out of your hand, that's probably free, right? Because it's just drop, right?
Drawing
a sword, okay, well, sheath, it's at your hip, that should be relatively easy. Yep. So we kind of meld that into into a movement or part of your movement or movement equivalent. And then when you start getting into more like, I got to dig this thing out of a pack.
Yeah.
Then we go, okay, well, that's your action. You
got
to go
find
it.
Or I've got a hammer that's presumably tied up on my belt, or I've got a longbow that needs to get strung up.
Yeah. So this came up again in my 5th edition game on Friday, where somebody had dropped their crossbow, because they're like, okay, great, so in order to switch my melee weapon, I drop my crossbow, pull out my sword, I'm attacking. Right, kills the guy in front of him.
Yeah.
Now he's got ample room. He says, well, now I want to sheath my sword and pick my crossbow back up off the ground. What kind of action is that?
Right.
And I ended up, I hemmed and hawed about it because we had just had this discussion. And I thought, well, I want to get this right. I want to know, like, not only what do I think, but what is the official 5th edition rule?
Yeah.
And so I dug into the player's handbook, and I was looking at what they call use item, right? Which is basically you get one kind of free interact with object per movement. And that can be things like drawing a sword or whatever, blah, 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 a bunch of stuff. And one of them was actually, pick up an axe off the ground.
Yeah.
That was one of their examples. Pick up an axe off the ground. And I thought, I guess pick up a crossbow versus pick up an axe. How different is that? I guess you can pick it up as part of your move and then shoot it. It feels like a lot to me in one round.
I agree. As we said last week, I feel there's been a general trend towards being more generous to those kinds of things. So I'm not surprised that's the rule in 5th edition. It's counter to language in 1st edition. There's an example of combat in the 1st edition DM's guide definitely has someone is exchanging weapons and therefore they do not get to attack this round. And I kind of like that tension. I actually have always kind of liked that tension of you're making a choice here. There's something you got to pay for it. There's a moment of vulnerability. I've actually always kind of liked that, and that is really how I still run my games. Is if it's a non-sword and you're changing weapons, you don't get to attack that round. And it hurts, and you feel it.
Yeah.
I don't mind that. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, what I'm finding is that list in 5th edition of the interact with object, that list is all over the map. And I really actually am more and more discovering I hate that list.
Okay.
Like, because one of them is drink a flagon of ale. And and a flagon, like the measurement of flagon, that's a lot of liquid. Like, what? Yeah. Are you serious?
Well, we had Sean K. Reynolds on the show in our last week, and he was talking about in the production of 3rd edition how he personally got up and did some long jumping tests in order to dial in the 3rd edition long jumping rule. I'm going to take a wild stab and say that the 5th edition drink a flagon one round was not actively tested, and maybe it should have been.
I mean, now that I've said that out loud, I actually might be wrong. It might not say flagon, but it's just it might be a tankard, whatever it is. But it's still like it's a lot of liquid. It reads to me as a lot.
As you now know.
Yeah.
Again, if you haven't seen Paul's experiment in drinking liquids while fighting, please look for that on our channel.
Yeah.
I'll put the link in the description after the show's over.
Yeah.
But you know, before we move off this,
there's other stuff on that list that I find really interesting, like open a door.
Yeah.
Right? Like in general, Dan, if you have somebody who's in OD&D who is moving from, they want to say, I want to go from here to there and attack that orc. Oh, there's a closed door between you and them.
Yeah.
Can they do that all in one round? I'm going to run over, fling open the door, run through, kill the orc.
Not for me. I mean, for me, my general sensibility is you get to move and you get to do one other thing.
Yeah.
That's my general sensibility. Not shoot, actually. Not cast spell. Those things you have to stand still for. But other than that,
you fire a range weapon you also make them not move for, huh?
That's standard D&D. That's chainmail. That's swords and spells. That's 1st edition. That's very that's locked into all those classic D&D.
Great.
And I like that. And now, see, one of the things that really bugs me with new school, 3rd edition and on, is if I want to run away from somebody and still shoot a missile weapon, that's not going to work. You can't move away from somebody and get a shot or a throw off. I'm more willing to accept run at somebody and throw an axe while you do it, but you can't backpedal and get enough momentum to make that successful. So, I'm personally very happy with the verisimilitude to do that kind of stuff. You got to stand still.
I blame the Lord of the Rings movies. The things that the things that Orlando Bloom does with a bow and that are just like what? And then somebody says, see that. I want my character to do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now you mentioned a little while ago you mentioned the different you mentioned playing BX. And nowadays I actually think if we go back to your 10th level fighter, you roll 10 attacks that we had in original D&D. I think that's the single biggest difference actually in the gameplay between the original D&D line, the AD&D line, and the basic lines. Basic didn't have that rule, didn't show up anywhere, the attacks per level. And that's a massive difference. That's an enormous difference if you're 10th level, 12th level, and you're fighting goblins. There's a massive difference between getting one attack per round, like in BX, and 12 attacks per round, like in original or AD&D. And for me, nowadays, one of the struggles I have is I go back to original AD&D, right? The monsters that you get those extra attacks against are exactly the monsters that show up in numbers of hundreds, right? The number appearing in OD&D, AD&D is specifically balanced for who the fighters get times 10 attacks against. And if you don't have that rule, if you're playing BX and you don't have that rule, then all of a sudden the number of goblins and orcs and bandits that show up are just overwhelmingly, just frankly, too many, because the rules expected that your fighters were getting 10 attacks per round against them. And that, for me, that's a big problem. And the single biggest difference between original and that box you just picked up.
Now, what I want to know is, I'm gonna quickly look in here and say, how many monsters, how many goblins am I actually facing? 2 to 8, 6 to 60. Yep, it does still have some of that, some of those big numbers in there, huh?
And if you orcs, even more 10 important, to 60. If,
they're not hundreds, you should, but they're
yeah. If you look at the expert, look at the expert rules, which are designed for wilderness play. Yeah, look in there, and you're going to see the larger numbers.
Does that really? I thought that we weren't going to see those creatures though, because those are in the basic book, not the expert book.
Oh, my bad. You're right. Yeah. I misspoke. You're right.
Yeah. So I think they cut the numbers down.
The number
down
in parentheses.
Bit.
You're right.
You know, it's
by
not
about
hundreds.
Times five.
It's tens, right?
The by 10 about to times 60. Five. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're right.
But you're right. You're right. It is still quite a few. Wait, before we lose track of this though, I want to show
Paul knew BX before I did. Good catch.
Manonin has this question for you, Dan, which I want to get up there. He says, of course you can retreat and shoot some weapons, especially crossbow, which is relying on mechanical energy, right? Like I've got my crossbow, it's loaded, surely I can back up and squeeze a trigger, right?
I would need to see an experiment of that. I would need to either do, see, or share an experiment in that.
That's going to be a tough one to do. That's going to we got to get a crossbow. We got to have space to use it. You know, I love the idea of doing little videos like the potion one where we do practical experiments. But I have another one I want to do about light radius. And I'm like, I need like a hangar. I need a giant open but dark space. I don't know how I'm going to do this.
Send me an email on that, because I have a link to someone who did it. A link to someone who did that in their house that might have some good suggestions for how to make that happen.
Oh, of darkness and light radius? Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or like a cave or an empty hospital or a factory.
We're talking about player actions and multiple attacks. I want to point out, right, like we know from filming The Big Bet, of course, that you know, fifth edition has basically gives this as a special ability to fighter types. Fighters, rangers, barbarians, paladins have an ability that unlocks usually at fifth level called extra attack, which is worded beginning at fifth level, you can attack twice instead of once whenever you take the attack action, which is confusing, honestly. The wording of that is not my favorite, because it's like subdividing an action, right? Is each attack an action? I think the answer is no. I think I'm taking one action to attack twice, which is awkward. Also, at the beginning of the show, I was paging through the book to remind myself about it and realized that the fighter one is slightly different than the paladin, ranger, and barbarian, in that the fighter one goes up. As you increase in level, you get more and more attacks, which is not true for the other three classes, which I think is interesting.
So your paladin, ranger, barbarian, once they get to two, that's as much as they get.
They
normally
just get the one extra, and that's it. And I assume that's
the stock fighter goes
point
on to three and four.
Yeah, I assume they're balancing there that like those other classes have other abilities that they're unlocking at those higher levels, and so they don't need the extra attack. Whereas fighter, this is what a fighter does, right? Fighter swings the sword, so give them more and more attacks.
Makes sense. Now that's fighters. Now on the other hand, right, who've gotten fairly liberal judgments about how many attacks they can make. Let's talk about spellcasters. There's been a pretty hard line held forever that spellcasters get just one spell per round. Now, in third edition, and even if you have a haste spell, right, original first, even if you have a haste spell, you still only get one spell per round.
Yep.
Maybe less than that, possibly.
Yep.
Third edition came in and for the first time allowed the haste spell to permit two spells per round, and they pretty much immediately regretted it. Every single caster and every single module had, here's what they do first. They cast haste, right? So that they can be casting two spells. Every single caster had to cast haste as their first thing if they had it. That was removed in the 3.5 revision. And now, I didn't know this a couple months ago, but now I'm keenly aware that in 5th edition, you have some spells that are listed as bonus actions that you can possibly cast as well as something else. But if you're going to cast another spell, it must be a cantrip. It must be a zero-level cantrip with that bonus action,
which is still a
very strict restriction on that.
It's a really interesting restriction, I think. Like, why just a cantrip? Why did they come up with that? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And it's a hard rule to find in the book, honestly.
I was
first introduced to that rule by watching Critical Role, and I had a moment of like, is this a Mercer House rule, or is this the rule as written? And I had to go digging for it. And it's in there. It is actually in there in the text.
Yep.
And likewise, you can find Twitter posts, I think, by Crawford or Perkins.
It's kind of inelegant. I mean, the first time you hear it, you kind of like, really? Isn't a mistake that you're making the first time someone says it? And I will confess that on The Big Bad, I screwed that up at least twice. And I think that maybe we've cut it out of the final episodes once we got it fixed. So we don't spend 5 minutes of us yakking about, like, really? Only a cantrip? Are you sure?
Yeah.
That might have gotten cut up. But yeah, to be perfectly honest, I screwed that up at least twice before I really nailed it down in my head. Not super elegant.
Yeah, there are some interesting rule stuff that we've learned from The Big Bad. But we cover that. We actually have a Big Bad development diary, which is on Tuesday nights. And I think we have earmarked one of those to talk over the interesting rulings, right? Is that this Tuesday? I can't remember.
I can look it up. That might be.
Yeah. It might be this Tuesday where we're going to talk about that stuff. So. Cool.
Good
cool. So point. Let's move on. But yeah, there's some interesting stuff there. Some surprises that Dan and I encountered over the course of running 5th edition. Really, for the first time, I think, together, really digging into 5th edition rules cooperatively, you and I.
This week we have scheduled tech rulings on the tech issues.
From this Tuesday is probably where we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, we can shift it around. If you want to talk about that this Tuesday, Paul, we can shift it around, but we have it scheduled for another week.
I suggest we not hash this out on this show. So,
that's what Tuesday's for.
let's move on to the other side of the screen, shall we?
Like, I think you're talking monsters.
I'm talking about monsters. Yep.
Now, real simple, and you go to original D&D, real freaking simple. By default, everything gets one attack, and it also does 1d6 damage. Like, that's pretty darn simple. Main exception that I can think of is in original D&D is Hydras, right? Hydras, the whole point to Hydras is they have a bunch of extra heads, and therefore they get a bunch of extra bite attacks. Other than that, just one attack per round.
What about dragons? It's either breathe or attack for dragons?
You know, correct. It's either breathe or attack.
Okay.
Now, you can have a debate about, in the original books, that bite also just 1d6, because it actually doesn't say anything else. As soon as you get to the first supplement, right?
Yep.
1 year later in the Greyhawk supplement, every single monster is given a variety of damage amounts. Some get multiple attacks, and the dragons are given a bite and two claws, which is what most of us are familiar with. So a year later, we're in the situation where we are now, more or less.
Yeah. So that's really the interesting point, right, for monsters originally across editions, is that multiple attacks, like claw-claw bite routine, which we're used to, right? Very used to, either it's got one attack or it's got three because of claw-claw bite. And kind of famously, like, this is what makes ghouls horrendous, right? Like, ghouls are probably the first thing that you encounter that have this, and they have the special ability to cause paralysis, and then once you're paralyzed, they're just raking in the damage, because this is a two-hit-die creature, I think, right? Or is it three?
It's
two-hit-die?
It's two. It's two.
Yeah, and three attacks every round. Troglodytes, I guess, are also famous for this, right? That's the other one you're going to get.
They have the stench.
But don't they also have claw-claw bite?
Yeah, but the thing about I think you're right. But the thing about the ghouls is that the claw bite, every single one, all three of those have the possibility of making paralysis.
Making paralysis, right?
And the no. damage isn't even really big. Like in original D&D, I think the ghoul damage is 1d6, 1d2, 1d2. Who cares about 1d2 damage except that it comes with paralysis?
Right. Right.
I mean, think about like a carrion crawler, right?
Yeah.
Carrion crawler has the same issue.
Yeah.
Their attacks do no damage. Okay, great. But they get eight of them, and every single one of them can all paralyze you. And I think I saw Frank Mentzer saying, we didn't quite get that right. That is like way too,
yeah.
in our game sessions, that is way too punishing how the carrion crawlers can just wreck an entire party because of the large number of attacks that we didn't quite dial in properly. So I think Frank was saying that, like, what I say is I can only attack four in one direction. So if your fighter comes at the head and starts attacking a carrion crawler, I only allow four in one direction.
So it's got four mouth tentacles and four butt tentacles.
Something like that. You ask Mr. Mentzer how he's interpreting that.
So, Mananen, I hope I'm saying your name correctly, says he's house-rolled his ghouls to only get one paralysis attack per round each. Now, interestingly, I bring that up.
I think that's a great ruling. I think that's a great solid ruling. You can say only the bite does it, right? That makes a lot of sense to me.
One thing I'll point out is in 5th edition, this has been greatly ramped down. Like,
yeah.
extremely, yeah. in all accounts, to the point where I'm really disappointed in ghouls in 5th edition.
Yeah.
That paralysis you're getting to save against every round, so it's not nearly as bad as it used to be.
Yeah.
B, they don't get multiple attacks.
Really?
Yeah. One attack.
I remember when I was first playing some 5th edition with our friend Christian, who's on 10 Den Rats, of course. Our party, first level, we get attacked by ghouls, and I start yelling at, as the expert D&D, or I start yelling at all the newbies, like, we're really in the shit now. Like, really, defend yourself, don't get attacked. If someone goes down, defend them, pull them out of the fight. Like, I'm terrified and sweating bullets.
Yeah.
And then someone gets paralyzed, and then we're immediately hit with the rule, one round later, roll again to shake off the paralysis, and I do a double take, and I'm like, are you serious? That's the rule? And Christian said, yeah. And I went, well, this isn't tense at all then. This isn't remotely as tense as I thought it was.
I'll point out the ghoul entry is fairly confusing. I'm not going to be able to get close enough to the camera there. But anyway, because under actions, it has both bite and claws. Claws, plural, as one action. Only the claws cause paralysis. The claws have a plus four to hit. It gets better. The claws have a plus four to hit and do 2d4 plus two damage. The bite is only plus two to hit and does 2d6 plus two damage. And there's no multi-attack entry. Nothing in here says they get multiple attacks. So you have to choose whether to claw or bite. Now, why is the question. And I believe I didn't really get this until I saw Keith Amon's answer, which is the notion is attack with the claws until you paralyze them. Now you have advantage to hit. Now start biting.
Yeah.
And that kind of makes sense. I get it gets into the theme of like, oh, they take you down, they try to paralyze you, and then they try to eat you. I'm like,
right.
Yeah, okay. But they're still way wimpier than they were in original. And I feel like there's the right answer is somewhere between these two things.
Yeah, I like, when I run original D&D, I still stick with the just one attack by default, kind of like Mananen is talking about. That feels good. And I kind of like the fact that I can throw more at them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the truth is that the tradition of ghouls is really coming directly out of Night of the Living Dead, right? Yeah. Night of the Living Dead, they don't call the monsters zombies. They actually call them ghouls at the end in this, TV broadcast.
Right,
they actually call them ghouls. That's where this whole thing comes from.
Interesting.
And I like being able to throw a whole lot at my players, right? I don't
want
to have to just throw two at my players. I'd like to throw 20, right? I would like that kind of Night of the Living Dead scene of like a whole bunch of these things.
Yes.
And by having, having one paralysis chance per round, I can do that. So that's one way I like to kind of hang my hat on original D&D.
One of my favorite ghoul encounters is actually in my R.A. Salvatore Presents the Vile Crypt of the Reawakened Sisterhood.
Nice.
Now, that's a fairly higher level game. You're expected to be, 5th, 6th level or so, which maybe ghouls are too wimpy for you, except that there's like 20 or 30 of them, and they're in a pit filled with water. So you fall, if you accidentally like probably only one person accidentally triggers this trap. They fall down the pit. They find themselves in water, and the water is full of swimming ghouls, and that's just hilarious and wonderful. And the right answer there is extract the person and get the hell out of there. That's my favorite.
That's delicious. That's delicious, sir. Well done.
Thank you.
Well done.
It's one of my favorite encounters in that one. So multiple attacks via claw bite is really the only balance point, right? And it's really interesting because I feel like it's interesting what you mentioned about carrion crawlers and Frank Mentzer's interpretation there about or the comment that they didn't get it right. Because I feel like maybe the concept of action economy maybe wasn't really thought about too critically in earlier editions.
Agreed.
And you and I think encountered this when we started running boss fight games, which is the progenitor of the Big Bad. And I remember when we set up to run the one with featuring Flame, the ancient red dragon, right? One of your biggest concerns was you've got a group of 8 to 10 players coming at me. Right. I'm playing this ancient red dragon. They're just going to drown me out in actions, right? I'm going to lose no matter how good my abilities are, no matter how good my stats are, because they're going to get 8 to 10 actions for every one action I get.
Yeah.
And how do you solve that?
I'm so glad you brought that up. And, not just that particular dragon, but really any, big bad villain at the end. A top-level spellcaster, your worst lich. It's totally the worst, right?
Like even not just a lich, but just like, what if I want to throw a 20th level magic user at them?
Yeah.
Right? Like, well, he's probably got low hit points and shitty armor class. They're just going to they're gonna destroy him in round two.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, your options there is, so your options are like the most obvious option is give him a whole bunch of mooks, give him a whole bunch of henchmen, which was our solution for the flame boss fight game. Or, make the villain or something really horrible, like, and I'm sure that many of us have made this mistake, make the villain's AC so good they can't be hit. Then it's not a fight in the other direction, or they're immune to attacks for some silly reason.
Yep.
So usually the solution has to be that your big bads have got to have a mob of troops around them.
Right, and that's how we solved it in that case with Flame. Right, we're like, he's an ancient red dragon. He's probably got some lizard men or troglodytes. I can't remember what we gave him. Some kind of creatures who are worship him like a god or something like that.
So you kind of get locked into that all the time. You kind of get locked into what the big villain fight looks like. It's always the big villain plus an army.
Yeah. So this is a case actually where I rather like what 5th edition has done, and their rules as surprisingly are found in the Monster Manual.
Okay.
Yeah.
You'll have to tell me what this is, because I've tentatively heard about this, but I'm really not sure exactly what people are talking about.
First of all, I find it fascinating when rules show up in the Monster Manual, right? But that's the only place where you can actually find these rules. They're kind of alluded to, I think, in the other books, but they're only really here. First of all, you start classifying higher level monsters as legendary. So because, 5th edition loves to classify everything. Okay, so now we have legendary monsters, and legendary monsters get legendary actions. And they're written specifically into the description of the monster. So I'm going to flip to our adult red dragon, as a pragmatic example. By the way, I like that 5th edition gives us 4 age levels of every dragon with unique separate stat blocks. I rather like that. I find that easier for me to process than, say, like, here's the stats for a dragon, and now here's a table to look up based on what age range they are, and it just, once I'm cross-referencing, I get... Mm. So
that's fair.
Adult Red Dragon is our not top tier. They give you a wormling, a young, an adult, and an ancient. But adult is the one I'm going to look at here. So legendary
actions. As an aside, is that all the age categories available in the game, or do they have more than that?
Those are all in the monster manual. Those are the 4 that exist for every type of dragon.
Okay.
Those 4, which I like. It fits in that whatever it is, 3 ± 2.
Number, I agree. Yeah. I mean, just the little thing about the dragon ages, right? Original D&D had 6 ages. AD&D had 8. Second edition had 10. And then I think third edition had 12. And I'm like, what are you doing to me? That's
well, here
you
go.
Don't need to
here
keep adding more and more stupid age categories.
Now here you get four, and they're different CRs, and I'll tell you the CRs I think are not consistent. I think that they're different by color, right? So an ancient red dragon is CR 24, whereas an ancient green dragon is CR 22.
That's been true in every edition, basically.
Yeah. So you still have a lot of variation, is my point.
Yeah, good.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me get into legendary actions, because the general rule about legendary actions is they're special actions that the monster can take in between other players' turns. So specifically, the dragon can take three legendary actions, choosing from the options below. Only one legendary action can be used at a time, and only at the end of another creature's turn. So the other player goes, and then you go, aha, time for a legendary action. As I'm looking at my adult red dragon, we have, first of all, we have multi-attack. That's our first thing. So we can always attack with two claws and one bite, and it details the bite and the claws. Also details a tail attack. And then I'm thinking, well, when's that come into play? At first I'm thinking, like, well, I don't, maybe if the bite, like, because of positioning, you're looking at the back end of the dragon, maybe I substitute the tail instead of the bite. It's got a frightful presence, and I'm not going to worry about that. Legendary actions. Here are your three options. Detect. The dragon makes a wisdom perception check. That's all it says.
Oh.
Maybe that's
okay.
Conditionally useful somehow. I'm not sure. The dragon's got a lot of senses. It's blind sight for 60 feet, dark vision 120 feet. Like, so I don't know. Maybe it needs a perception check to like detect an invisible creature or something. I don't know. Tail attack. Dragon makes a tail attack. I can do that as a legendary action. So I kind of like that, right? So now basically the multi-attack makes sense to me. I'm attacking claw bite generally, and then in between somebody else's round, oh, the tail whips around and smacks into you. That's kind of cool. And then finally, wing attack, which, by the way, costs two legendary actions. So now we're getting really fidgety with it. You have three legendary actions, but you're not going to use two wing attacks in any given pass. Dragon beats its wings. Every creature within 10 feet must succeed on a dexterity saving throw or take some bludgeoning damage and be knocked prone. Kind of interesting.
I think you might want to look at... So William, about three comments ago, said that there was a template in a third edition supplement that basically did the same thing. It sounds like that was the initial stab at that kind of thing.
But wait, there's more. Yeah. There's more. That's legendary actions.
Oh, no.
There's also lair actions. So possibly your monster lives in a special lair, and the lair itself gets actions. So our adult red dragon, and then so basically for each of the dragon entries, it gives you what's its lair like. All right, so it tells us that the red dragon generally lives in snow-capped peaks, deep underground, in caverns. Prefers things with geothermal activity or volcanic. Right, so okay, we're getting a sense of where red dragons like to live, deep underground into caves that are very hot. Maybe there's lava, right? The lair actions, on initiative count 20, losing ties, the dragon takes a lair action to cause one of the following effects. Magma erupts from a point on the ground, a tremor shakes the lair, or volcanic gases release, and they're all kind of weird. You don't like that, huh, Dan? You don't like lair actions?
I might have to, I mean, this is the first I'm really getting the rule, so... Yeah. What I say next, I might have to reflect on and retract at a later date. Not thrilled about it. Not super thrilled. And the thing now, okay, let me speak positively first, right? I see the problem why this is trying to solve, right? It's exactly this one big bad against a party and getting slammed on the action economy. This has been a legitimate problem. I see why they're trying to solve that. I was thinking, you know, this issue in terms of, like, I was reading some X-Men comics a couple weeks back, right? And commonly the X-Men have to fight Magneto, and Magneto is presented as sufficiently uber powerful that he alone is a match for the whole team. The general, and I think this is true about comics in general, the general cadence, I guess, is that you don't see a panel where every member of the team literally blasts the bad guy with all their powers all at once. That doesn't happen. What happens is Cyclops says, I'm going to get him with my heat vision. Zap, and Magneto fends that off. And then Wolverine says, now it's my turn. Snicked, and he jumps up and Wolverine throws him on the roof, right?
Yeah.
And they go one at a time, and everybody, at least narratively, gets a little highlight. And the villain, one by one, fends them off.
Yep.
You know, I think there's some games nowadays that, what am I trying to think of here? Maybe like Dungeon, Mard, what's that current narrative game everybody plays? Dungeon World, thank you. Yeah. Where if I'm not misremembering, you know, only the players are proactive. Anytime they do something, by default, the target is presumably trying to counter it at the same time. My problem with the 5th edition rule is, as someone who, like, one of my main theses is I want to be concrete. I want to be more concrete. Things that everybody can understand, even if you're a new player. I don't want to be abstract and game mechanic rule-y. Is where exactly in the world does the epic action come from? Where does the lair action come from? Now, if you told me it's a rule, I don't see where in the fiction it's coming from, right? So if you told me, like, look, we have a rule whereby dragons have a whole lot of attacks, and as far as we're concerned, you can intersperse them. Like, you don't have to go all at once. You can intersperse your multiple attacks between other players. Great. If you had recommendations for crazy things that might happen in a dragon's lair, great. But I'm like, really? Is the dragon controlling it? Is that the narrative fiction we have now?
No, so, I don't. No, I don't think the dragon necessarily. Although I grant you that some of the text almost reads like the dragon is controlling it. The dragon causes this thing to happen. But I think the point is basically what they're doing. I think is taking what you would have done normally in encounter design anyway, like say putting a whole bunch of ghouls in a pit full of water, and building it into the monster itself to try and help you with that encounter design to say, okay, you want to ramp up the danger, you want to make it harder, they're in a special lair, and here are the extra abilities they get for the lair. I actually rather like it. I agree that, like, presenting it as if the dragon is doing it is weird, but I feel like it's stuff we would have seen in old modules anyway, just with good, clever encounter design, and they're just bringing it forward into the monster description, which I kind of like, honestly. Like, I feel like now I could make a really badass flame encounter where it's deep underground and all this stuff's going on, because they live in a dangerous place, and sometimes magma erupts, and sometimes, you know, volcanic gases erupt, and to the party's detriment, right? The dragons lived here for centuries. It's used to this stuff. It knows how to predict them and not get in the way of them. Maybe it even knows, like, it hears the pop, 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 and it knows that this thing's coming, so it's going to position itself to try and force you into a bad spot so you get hit by the magma. You know, like your Wesley fighting ROUSs.
Yeah, I'll have to. I see what it's trying to resolve, and I'll have to reflect on it more. My initial hot take is that to me it feels de-linked from the narrative fiction and confuses me with the mechanics.
I disagree. I like it quite
a bit. Overly abstract.
I like the abstraction, frankly. I like that it's basically helping me to encounter them. Now, I don't have to have them in a lair. It's not telling me that, like, every red dragon forever is in a lair and this is the only way red dragons exist. But I have this option of, oh, I want an even nastier ancient red dragon. Let's put him in a lair and get all these lair actions. And it's giving me clever ideas for stuff that can happen there. I rather like it. I think it's just kind of taking that kind of stuff that I would see in a good adventure anyway, and again, kind of just transposing it into the monster manual.
I agree that it's good stuff to have in an adventure and encounter design.
So here's another thing, just to throw you another loop. Dan, in 5th edition, how often can a dragon breathe fire?
Okay, the last edition that I really knew was 3rd, and I know that everybody disagrees with me, but to me, 3rd and 5th look 95% of the same, so my guess, Paul, is going to be as much as it wants every 1d3 rounds.
Nope. So 5th edition has introduced the idea of actions that are on a recharge, which requires a die roll. So...
yeah.
On its turn, instead of multi-attacking, the dragon can breathe fire. Each subsequent turn, if it wants to do that again, it's got to roll a d6, and only on a 5 or 6 can it do it.
So, like I just said, once every 3 rounds.
Well, except that it's a die roll every time, right? So it might not be every 3 times. I might get it the next round, or I might... It's a little more randomness, I think.
So, this is exactly the kind of, like, third... I, like... probabilistically, it's once every 3 rounds, and I literally don't see any difference in what you just said.
except that I've had encounters where it breathed three rounds in a row, and I've had encounters where like it never breathed for like eight rounds in a row.
Which is what would happen in
third edition. Well, the latter couldn't happen in third, right?
Okay.
You could never just have a... If I'm rolling...
That's a huge difference.
It's different. I'm not saying it's huge, but I'm saying it is
different. How many fights last eight rounds? They don't even last eight rounds, right? They tend to last four rounds, so... Anyway, pretty similar. Yep, great. I'm glad you told me that.
Okay. Don't agree on only last four rounds. Absolutely not. Okay. I mean, based on the game I just ran on Friday, we had minute-long durations run out. So that's 10 rounds. That's over 10 rounds of a fight.
Okay. Anyway, I agree.
The randomness
last average of 4 or 5.
The randomness is similar, but I think it's interesting that they're pitching it as a recharge, and it makes for a dramatic moment. Every round when I control that dragon, I'm going, "All right, we're going to see if it's going to breed this round." And you know me, I roll my dice out in the open. Here we go, in a 5 or 6, breath weapon's coming, and the party, and I roll the d6, and okay, it doesn't breathe this round, fine.
I actually agree that this is a great tweaking of that third edition rule. It's actually a better way of handling that same determination. Yeah. And again, echoes right out of original D&D, right? And there it was expressed as a decision that the dragon was making, same thing in original D&D. Dragons would presumably breathe on the first round, and then you would have to roll dice to see if they decided to breathe on a subsequent round. So I like it. Totally agree with the tension of the dice being rolled live, and again, better, right? Better than the third edition need to track. Right now, you don't need to track that number that you rolled 2 or 3 rounds ago. And I do agree the fifth edition mechanic for that same third edition idea is an improvement. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I like it. And they've used it for more than just dragons. There's other things that have abilities on a recharge. And the odds of recharge, I don't know if it's always a D6. I think it varies. Or at least maybe the number you have to roll varies. I like it as a design thing to toy with, right? And these are things that certainly when folks are on Dungeon Masters Guild are making, volumes of monsters, these are all the many precedents that they can play with and tinker with. I didn't even mention the other thing. I think back on the flip side of the scale, the very low end, when we're talking about like lots and lots of creatures, and I don't know when this came in, but we were talking about like hundreds of goblins. What about thousands of rats? Right? In fifth edition, most of those things are introduced as a single swarm creature. And then they just batch them up. Yeah, is that third edition? Is that third edition-ism? It is.
Interesting. Yep.
It's interesting. Don't mind it.
You can point to... Yeah.
Don't mind it. It's fine.
Yeah. Makes sense. You can point to the, like the insect plague spell, which you're keenly aware of at this point.
Yeah, for sure.
Due to recent experience. Not terrible. I don't think I used swarms a whole heck of a lot in third edition, so I don't think I have a huge... Yeah.
I've used them once
it.
Or twice in 5th, and I like it just because, frankly, I would never send normal rats against a party. Like, already giant rats are played out. Normal rats? That's so boring. Right? And what am I just going to roll, like, fistfuls of d20s? They're just going to stomp them.
Yes.
It's just silly. I like the abstraction there. I like the abstraction of, like, it's a swarm of, oh, God, there's rats everywhere. It's a swarm. And it gives that sense of being overwhelmed, right, but still a thing that you could track against and just simplifies the whole process for me. I like it.
And there's also, I'll also say there's an issue about, like, if rats even get a whole hit point, is that unbalanced, actually? They don't, they're so much smaller than a human being that, like, they arguably one shouldn't even be worth a whole hit point. So I can see a lot of reasons to do that.
I know we're nearly out of time, Dan. I'm kind of curious because I steamrolled past it. Layer actions aside, what do you think about legendary actions?
Yeah, I was kind of, my comments would go for that. It's a little too abstract for me. I'm not seeing where it's coming out of the fiction.
Yeah, I enjoy it. So some of the monsters in Vile Crypt of the Ruaken Sisterhood are legendary and have legendary actions. There's some fun stuff there. It is every time I've put legendary monsters against my players. It infuriates the crap out of them. Oh, gets to do another thing? You got to be kidding me. Oh, come on.
Okay, well, there's a point in its favor, I'll say. all right, warm, okay, coming around,
yeah,
great.
yeah, it's super fun. A lot of them, like some of them, have movement in there. Legendary action, yeah. Move 30 feet. Do not provoke any attack of opportunities while you do so. That's a great one.
You know, as just other options, yeah. If you go, you know, tweaking your rules, I mean, we've been playing some Troika lately, and there the round sequence is, if you're doing it physically, every villain, every person in the at the table gets a chip thrown in a bag, and you just shake it up, pull out a chip, yeah. That's the next person to go. There's also a chip that just says end of round. So you might have like 1, 2, 3 bad guys go, none of the players have gone, and the chip comes up, end of round. Great, next round. All the chips go back in. Right? And we, you know, and at least you get this like kind of back and forth. You don't have to track numbers on a list.
Yeah.
People aren't rolling initiative. It's funny when you have 1, 2, 3 villains going one after the other. Quite frequently, there'll be some player that never got to go over 3 rounds.
Yeah,
right?
That sounds kind frustrating.
Of becomes a drag for that player. And the other thing that we ran into is that there's no way to double check if you just forgot somebody. So at least once or twice, a referee forgot to put a chip to the virtual bag. 3 or 4 rounds went in. One player went, "Hey, boy, it's really uncanny how I'm not getting to do anything." And the referee went, "Oh crap, I forgot to put it in for you." So that was like an additional downside.
That's rough.
That. Yeah. Yeah, I kind of felt for everybody around that.
Yeah,
but yeah, you know, that's interesting ways of getting kind of an interspersion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of without bogging down the game too much.
I do like anything that's going to try and solve that problem of I want this giant horrible monster and I want the party to attack it, and I want it to be a fun challenge for them. And I don't have to like, okay, I guess it's also got an army of minions because it needs them. Otherwise, it's screwed.
I see why. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I see that as a really, really legitimate thing to try to work around.
Yeah. Big one that I super want to do. And okay, here's a crazy thing I'm going to admit on stream. I have never in my life GM'd a game where I got to control a beholder. And when I was looking for creatures that have legendary actions, I thought, surely a beholder does. And I started reading the beholder entry, and wow. Yep, it's got a bunch of legendary actions, and it actually sounds kind of fun, and I super want to run a 5th edition game with a beholder in it now.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. I've written encounters with the beholder, but I agree, I've never gotten to actually run it.
Basically, one of its primary legendary actions is, it fires a ray from one of its eye. Roll 1d10. And I just love that.
For a random eye.
For which eye it is, yep. Like, that's exactly the thing that I want randomness on. That is exactly the thing I want on. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. I mean, frankly, now you've got me thinking about as a much more rules-like mechanism, just having some rule that says if there's a monster that has lots of attacks, it can get interspersed. Yep. Between the player actions. So you got a Hydra, they can do one in between each player. I would be amenable to that.
I mean, the interesting thing too is that there's a little bit of a scalar there where it says they can take up to 3 legendary actions, but they can only take one after a player and they can't double them up. So if they're only fighting 1 or 2 players, they have less legendary actions.
Do you like that?
I'm not sure. I've not seen it in action, so I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, I like the flow of, well, you're never seeing it do 2 things in a row. But I don't know. Yeah, does it balance well? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Again, I have hard time digesting that in the fiction, but now I'm repeating myself.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Just looking here in first edition how it got it. So I guess if you were at least above it, then just all 10 of the ice docks could all fire at you. That's nifty.
Yeah, I think they were...
Put that in your well.
Yeah. Frankly, I think the reason I've never gotten a GM a beholder is because they're just too powerful, and I never had players who were capable of dealing with it.
Agreed. I had in the last outdoor spoliation game, I had an encounter that had 3 gas spores, right? The things that look like beholders but aren't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I intentionally did that to try to communicate, well, do you think Dan's going to throw three beholders at you all at once for the first time? So I kind of did that specifically to try to communicate that probably was fake.
That's funny. It's funny.
Yeah, never had an actual beholder. That's great.
I may have called out the gas spore as my least favorite monster on a panel once.
Yes, I recall. I recall that. I don't. Anyway, separate. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. We are over time.
Favorite and least favorite monsters.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Put that in the list. Great. All right, folks, we are out of time. This is it for our action economy discussion. What did we forget? Did we miss something? Probably. Leave us some comments, and maybe in season three we'll get to it. But I'm definitely not going week three on this topic. We're done.
We were going as fast as we could. And we took as many licks as we possibly could, and we are out of time.
So
yeah. I don't know if you could tell, but that we were kind of playing hurry up offense there.
Yeah, for sure.
Thanks everybody for their comments for helping us. Actually, that was actually very super helpful for you to chime in today and help guide us on this particular highly sharp topic.
I'll quickly mention, since we're running out of time here, one of our new Patreon benefits is access to our private Discord, where after these shows, Dan and I frequently go and keep talking about this stuff. So if you want to join in on some of that chatter, join our Patreon and you'll get access to that Discord server, and you can maybe have a little chat with us after one of these shows.
We're gonna do that right now, Paul.
If you're
a patron, please jump over to our Discord server and tell us what we overlooked here and for the next half hour or so, and we will enjoy seeing you face to face. Would be even better.
Yeah,
frankly.
Great. Good point. All right. So, like I said, if you have any thoughts, if you're watching this on VOD, you have some thoughts about stuff we missed or stuff you want to talk about in terms of action economy, leave us a comment, and we will filter it into the future show list.
Absolutely. Remember, if you're new to the show, that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch and Facebook under the handle Wandering DMs, all one word, on all of those sites.
You can also listen to our show in audio-only podcast format if you prefer. That's available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Likewise, it is carried by various podcast carriers like iTunes and Google Podcast. If you are listening to us on one of those carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us. That helps us out a lot.
It definitely does. And as usual, thanks to our patrons and our growing number of patrons every week who support the show. We could not do this without you. If you would like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And when you do that, you'll be able to jump into the Discord server and have a continued chat with us after the talk show, like we're going to do in just a couple minutes. Also, remember upcoming shows. We do have our Dev Diary session where we talk about producing The Big Bad coming up Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Paul will have 10 Dead Rats again from 8 to 10 p.m. right before Critical Role on Thursday. And then don't forget, when we come back next Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we will have special guest James Malazuski on of Grognardia. He took an 8-year hiatus from writing his highly acclaimed blog posts on old school D&D at Grognardia. He has recently come back just a couple weeks ago, has been producing lots of interesting new content, and I personally can't wait to get to talk to Grognardia's James Malazuski on September 20th. So please look for that. Don't forget about our subscription drive, right? If you have not subscribed to YouTube yet, please do that. Go to wanderingdms.com, click through our subscription drive, and you'll be in the drawing for every prize that we could possibly put into a U.S. postal box.
And I'm going to drop that one more time into the chat so everybody can see it. That likewise ends on the 20th. So the very day when we are talking with James, that will be the final day of that competition. So get your entries in.
So we'll look for you. We'll look forward to having everybody in our future shows. Thanks to everybody for the comments and questions today. That was super, super intriguing to hear your observations. Don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, so please join us next week for James Malazuski and another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.